As running mate to Dwight David Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, accused of pocketing campaign contributions, addresses the TV viewing audience with his infamous Checkers speech.
My fellow Americans, I come before you tonight as a candidate for the vice presidency and as a man whose honesty and integrity has been questioned. Now, the usual political thing to do when charges are made against you is to either ignore them or to deny them without giving details. I have a theory, too, that the best and only answer to a smear or to an honest misunderstanding of the facts is to tell the truth. And that's why I'm here tonight. I want to tell you my side of the case. I'm sure that you have read the charge and you've heard it, that I, Senator Nixon, took $18,000 from a group of my supporters. Not 1 cent of the $18,000 or any other money of that type ever went to me for my personal use. Do you think that when I or any other senator makes a political speech, has it printed, should charge the printing of that speech and the mailing of that speech to the taxpayers? Do you think, for example, when I or any other senator makes a trip to his home state to make a purely political speech, that the cost of that trip should be charged to the taxpayers? Well, I know what your answer is. It's the same answer that audiences give me whenever I discuss this particular problem. The answer is no. Well, then the question arises, you say, well, how do you pay for these and how can you do it legally? And there are several ways that it can be done, incidentally, and that it is done legally in the United States Senate and in the Congress. The first way is to be a rich man. I don't happen to be a rich man, so I couldn't use that way. Another way that is used is to put your wife on the payroll. Let me say, incidentally, that my opponent, my opposite number for the vice presidency of the Democratic ticket, does have his wife on the payroll and has had her on his payroll for the past 10 years. Now, just let me say this. That's his business, and I'm not critical of him for doing that. You will have to pass judgment on that particular point. But I have never done that, and I'm proud to say tonight that in the 6 years I've been in the House and the Senate of the United States, Pat Nixon has never been on the government payroll. Let me say, incidentally, that some of you may say, well, that's all right, Senator. That's your explanation. But have you got any proof? And I'd like to tell you this evening that just an hour ago, we received an independent audit of this entire fund. It's an audit made by the Price Waterhouse and Company firm and the legal opinion by Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, lawyers in Los Angeles, the biggest law firm and, incidentally, one of the best ones in Los Angeles. I'm proud to be able to report to you tonight that this audit and this legal opinion is being forwarded to General Eisenhower. And I'd like to read to you the opinion that was prepared. It is our conclusion that Senator Nixon did not obtain any financial gain from the collection and disbursement of the fund by Dana Smith, that Senator Nixon did not violate any federal or state law by reason of the operation of the fund. Now that, my friends, is not Nixon speaking, but that's an independent audit which was requested because I want the American people to know all the facts, and I'm not afraid of having independent people go in and check the facts. And that is exactly what they did. One other thing I probably should tell you, because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me too. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat on the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left on this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep him. And now, finally, I know that you wonder whether or not I am going to stay on the Republican ticket or resign. Let me say this. I don't believe that I ought to quit because I'm not a quitter. But the decision, my friends, is not mine. I would do nothing that would harm the possibilities of Dwight Eisenhower to become president of the United States. And for that reason, I am submitting to the Republican National Committee tonight through this television broadcast the decision which it is theirs to make. Let them decide whether my position on the ticket will help or hurt. And I'm going to ask you to help them decide. Wire and write the Republican National Committee whether you think I should stay on or whether I should get off. And whatever their decision is, I will abide by it. But just let me say this last word. Regardless of what happens, I'm going to continue this fight. I'm going to campaign up and down in America until we drive the crooks and the communists and those that defend them out of Washington.
Report from Senator Richard Nixon, nominee for the office of Vice President of the United States.
Thanks for returning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to Steven Pinker talk about the decline of violence. Steven Pinker is a professor of psychology at Harvard University and the author of 8 books, including The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined.
Fortunately, we are smart. We can gradually, in bits and pieces, try to improve our condition. And one of the ways that we do it is to try to incentivize everyone to forswear violence at the same time. And what the common denominator is between these 5 pacifying forces, I suggest, is they all jigger with the payoffs in the matrix that, and they turn the pacifist dilemma into more of a rational actor circumstance in which we all opt for the nonviolent cell.
We have a question from the floor that I think was inevitable, so why don't we just go to it? So what about the U.S.? Right? Why does it seem such a violent place compared to other places?
Yes.
And this is from GENNAMB, which is probably someone's Twitter name. I'm sure you're out there.
So. Okay. Yeah, and yeah. It's an excellent question, yeah. Because by a number of criteria, the United States is more violent than other Western democracies. Our rate of homicide is 2 to 5 times higher than that of other Western democracies. We start more wars. We 33 of the 50 states have capital punishment, which has been abolished everywhere else. The answer goes back to settlement patterns in American history. One way to begin to answer that question is to point out the United States isn't a country. It's at least 2 countries. And if you look at the northern and coastal states, they're Vermont is kind of like an honorary Denmark. The rates of violence in the northern and coastal states are still higher than those of Europe, but not as high. Southern state and western states have much higher rates of homicide. It's the blue states that have abolished capital punishment tend to be more dovish in foreign policy. So in part, this is a question about the American South and West. And I think the simplest answer is that they lived in a condition of anarchy until fairly recently. Historically speaking, the cliche, the closing of the American frontier, was only in the 1890s, and that kind of marked a symbolic end to anarchy in the United States. And the mountainous south of the Hatfields and McCoys and Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and so on was a kind of archetype of American history. What happened is often in anarchic societies, you see a culture of honor developing. That is, that your only protection consists of maintaining a belligerent stance where you have to avenge any insult regardless of the cost to you, and that was your only protection. That got, I think, embedded into particularly Southern and Western culture, but to some extent also other parts of the country, whereas the Europeans were kind of beaten into submission by their autocratic kings many centuries ago, and they kind of got used to the idea that you can outsource your protection to the government. That's the simplest answer.
So how do we get the South or the areas in which there's the most guns to melt their assault rifles and turn them into iPads?
Yeah, I don't have an easy answer to that question because as you point out, Andre, the the guns are out there. And, you know, the gun lobby, having created this situation, now says, well, there's nothing we can do about it, and so let's make it even worse by having everyone, even more people, have guns to defend themselves against all those people with guns.
I'm by no means an expert on sort of on the statistics behind gun use and gun violence in the U.S., but some of the readings that I've done, I've noted that there are different ways of, you know, looking at these statistics. So, for example, if you look at the number of gun owners in the U.S. versus, say, Canada, the numbers are pretty equivalent.
Yeah.
But the number of guns per owner, there's a huge difference, right?
Like, no, that's so a very important point. That's absolutely right. And, moreover, consistent with your statistic is that the number of households with guns in the United States has gone down.
Right.
Even though the number of guns has gone up. So it means that there are a smaller and smaller number of people who own bigger and bigger arsenals.
And this makes me nervous because, of course, our weapons are getting more and more sophisticated. So even if the overall number of violent people in the population declines, it takes fewer and fewer to inflict more and more damage, as we saw in some of these mass shootings.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
So how do we fight that kind of growth in these outliers of people who are particularly violent?
Well, I think guns themselves probably aren't the main place to look for an answer. Although there are a lot of common sense gun control measures that any sane person would have to agree should be implemented. But the U.S.-Europe difference is not just a difference in the availability of guns. So if you subtract out all the gun homicides in the United States and you just look at the homicides committed with ropes and candlesticks and daggers and so on, we still kill people at a higher rate. Even if you take out all the gun murders, we are more violent. And I don't want to endorse anything that the NRA says, but there is some truth to the idea that it really is people who kill people rather than guns that kill people. And so that's why I think the psychology and sociology of violence is probably more important than just the weaponry. In talking about rampage shooters, there's not much that you can do, but it's, to be honest, it's not, as far as violence goes, it's not that much of a problem in the following kind of callous sense, that is, of raw numbers. So Sandy Hook killed, what, 27 people altogether? 22?
26, I think.
I don't know the exact number.
Something like that. But, you know, every day in the United States, 30 to 40 people get killed. And so after all that round-the-clock coverage of Sandy Hook, they didn't, the cable news networks didn't say, oh, and by the way, we've had another Sandy Hook and a half today. And, you know, then on Thursday, we've had another Sandy Hook and a half today again, and every single day since then. So these are, there are two categories of violence that are peculiar in that they generate a massive amount of publicity, discussion, concern, and inflict relatively little damage. And one of them is rampage shootings. And the other is terrorism. Mm-hmm. And this is terrorism. The worst terrorist attack in history killed 2,800 people, 9/11. And in the United States, every year, 16,000 people are killed in homicides. But it's not a coincidence, because why do people blow themselves up? Why do people shoot up a school and then shoot themselves? Well, it's the only guaranteed way to get the world's attention. They know that, if you, as Adam Langford, who just wrote a book on suicide terrorism, points out, let's say you wanted to become famous nationwide, worldwide. What could you do to guarantee yourself to become famous? Make a great scientific discovery? You know, forget that. compete on American Idol.
American Science Idol.
American Science Idol. No, you want to become famous. There actually is one guaranteed way to become famous, and that is kill a lot of innocent people. Now, we've set up that incentive structure. It's hard to know how to reverse it. That being there, people with a grievance, whether political in the case of terrorism or personal in the case of someone who has been dissed, insulted, we've created this opportunity for them to have their platform. Mm-hmm. Namely, they kill a bunch of people and we put them on page one.
So, I've got a...
I'll just quickly follow up
from
and
the
then
floor
you can...
Yeah.
Putting that into the pacifist dilemma, you know, is that an argument for not covering, the media not covering these mass shootings or these sort of large events? Or would that really never happen, given how much that sells?
I think it is an argument for making news coverage and policy discussion more in line with the statistics. So the both the round-the-clock coverage of these rampage shootings and the response to terrorism. Our society was turned upside down. We started two foreign wars that we're still in as a response to terrorism. If you looked at the numbers, like what ought you to do if you're a government official in charge of your citizenry's safety? What should you do to maximize that safety? And the idea is turn your society upside down and start wars to reduce terrorism. It does not make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of questions and comments from the floor regarding, increase of women's rights and how that plays in here. And so I'll just read one of them from Kate G. Scott. Why do more rights for women mean less aggression in society?
Yeah, no, excellent question. I mentioned there are several motives for violence, and I think there's some where there's not much of a sex difference. If you're the head of state, you're defending your country's interests in a game board of a lot of other hostile states. Any woman who is running a country is going to act in the interests of that country, and that's going to include waging war when that's the rational thing to do. But and that's the category of violence, of simply violence as a means to an end. And I don't expect a sex difference. But when it comes to kind of stupid macho violence, knife fights over a parking space, road rage, fights over a pool table, fights over national honor where nothing is at stake except national honor, campaigns of bloodthirsty conquest and, insane wars of aggression, it looks like that's more of a guy thing. And also cross societies in non-state societies. There is, anthropologists have documented a correlation that that the societies that are constantly raiding each other tend to be the societies where, I'm going to make a little bit of an understatement, you don't have a whole lot of women's rights. And the societies where there is more egalitarianism, they tend to be less warlike. Now, it's hard to know what's cause and what's effect, but there is a correlation. So I think in terms, and you can even see this projected into modern societies where, you know, anyone who's worked in a mixed sex environment is familiar with, you know, women saying about their male colleagues, oh, you know, typical male behavior, namely pointless contests of what I call competitive distance urination. So there's that. There's a second factor pointed out by Malcolm Potts, a public health researcher in the UK, that when the chief battleground, kind of ground zero in battles between the sexes is reproduction. The societies that control women control their reproduction by you know, selling them off as brides, you know, protecting their chastity, forcing them into to become kind of round-the-clock baby factories. Societies that where women have more autonomy, the first place they exercise that autonomy is their own sexuality, their own reproduction. And when you have women's rights, women have fewer babies, they have them later, and as a result, in more female-empowered societies, you're less likely to have youth bulges. And since another thing that goes along with women's empowerment is these societies are less likely to either murder female newborns or abort female fetuses, if you've got, you know, lots and lots of babies coming out and lots of them are boys, well, that leads to trouble down the line. Mm-hmm. You get youth bulges of unemployed, unattached young men, and that means trouble. Societies where women control their reproduction are societies that have fewer of these youth bulges.
You know, just to follow up here, I mean, you wrote the blank slate about how it's not, right?
We're not blank slates,
yes.
Right.
So this is sort of a case study. I mean, do you feel that when people talk about mass shootings or terrorist attacks, are we becoming willing to credit the fact that they are largely driven by men? Should we be more upfront about that? And should we biologize that and be frank about it?
Well, I think we should biologize it in trying to understand it, keeping in mind that these are all statistical generalizations.
Yeah.
We shouldn't biologize it in our system of politics and justice, where we should treat individuals as individuals. So that's the short answer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Men of anger, men of war, my heart is filled with love. Tell me what you are fighting for. My heart is filled with love. This death I see won't make me numb. My heart is filled with love. Every boy, a mother's son, my heart is filled with love. Raise your voices, spread the news, my heart is filled with love. Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, Jew, my heart is filled with love. They all teach the golden rule. My heart is filled with love. Do unto others as you'd have them do. My heart is filled with love. I will not fear these foreign tongues. My heart is filled with there is a place for everyone. My heart is filled with love. I cannot make their will my own. just the same. My heart is filled with love. Hope is rising from this place. My heart is filled with love. Divine wisdom, amazing grace. My heart is filled with love. Men of anger, men of war, filled with love. Tell me what you are fighting for. My heart is filled with love. Tell me what you are fighting for. My heart is filled with love. My heart is filled with love. My heart is filled.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.